This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas, powered by U Mobile.
Good morning, you're listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Shazana Mokhtar. Why do some countries remain poor despite continuous policy efforts over decades to chart an economic path out of poverty? Joining me to discuss this today is Stefan Durkon, Professor of Economic Policy with the Blavatnik School of Government at Oxford University. He's also the author of Gambling for Development, where based on decades of working in global development, he puts forth a theory on why some countries succeed and others fail. Good morning, Stefan. Welcome to The Breakfast Grill.
Well, thank you for having me.
Now, early on in your book, you dismiss the idea of a silver bullet in developmental economics. There's no one foolproof set of policy prescriptions to bring a country out of poverty. Now, before we go into your theory specifically, what are some of the economic silver bullets being bandied about that you think are misplaced or misleading in thinking about development?
Well, it is very common in policy circles to have not very much patience with ideas. And so actually the silver bullets has a lot to do with people thinking, you know, new technology or a massive new new agricultural innovation like a new seed will suddenly change everything. And of course, technologies and new ideas can matter. But the issue is really is that to be successful, it usually requires quite a lot of different things. It needs to have a patience. It needs a lot of trying out what works in particular places. So this whole idea that suddenly there is a simple new technology or a new policy framework or a certain economic measure will do everything is really not the way to go about it.
I guess there's just something really appealing about believing that this new fangled idea could help change things around. But that's really not the reality of it. And economic progress that alleviate poverty depends very much on a country's individual circumstances, as you put in your book, but also on what you call the existence of a development bargain among the elite of a country. So what do you mean by this?
Well, let me make sure that people don't misunderstand when I use the word elite, first of all. So I'm thinking here people that have power and influence in a society, in a particular state, in a particular country. So that could be people in politics, of course. That could also be people in the military. It could be people also in the business environment, the business elite. It could be broader. It could be people in civil society, public intellectuals, even academics in well-known universities. So these are people that have power and influence in a society. And so when I was thinking about why is it that such a diverse set of countries over the last 30, 40 years starting to begin to take off, you know, and beginning to get economic growth and better development. And why I say a diverse set of countries, because you have places like China in there. You, of course, had Malaysia in there, South Korea, but you go west, you have Bangladesh, and in a likely case, you go to Africa, you have Ghana, you have Ethiopia. These are very, very different countries and states in terms of what the exact politics and policies they were actually implementing. So they're quite diverse and they're looking for a common element. And basically every state that you observe tends to have somehow an implicit, sometimes explicit, but usually implicit deal between these different elite players. That's an elite bargain. And that's quite a common theory also in political science, to look at a society as somehow or another an elite bargain, a deal between these different people of power and influence. Now, the important and common element between all these different countries that seem to have been successful is that actually they had a particular feature to that underlying deal, a shared commitment to actually making a success of growth and development. Now, we may find that self-evident. Now, I can go around the world and find quite a lot of states where the elite bargain seems to be entirely about just stealing from the people. Yeah. The elite bargain seems to be entirely about, if I'm in power, I give jobs or power and influence to those who support me and no one else, or those who come from my ethnic group and whatever. And so somehow that underlying commitment to growth and development is really an important common element to these different societies that have been able to take off in development. And that's what I call a development bargain.
Hmm. So from your research then, Stefan, what motivates elites to strike a bargain and prioritize national development over other interests? Because you described that there are a whole lot of bargains that could be meted out, you know. So what leads them to choose development?
Now, that's an, of course, a really fascinating question, because it's really, the more you think about it, you're surprised that they do it. Because the most attractive position for an elite, and these are the people with power and influence in a society, is the status quo. Change is actually quite dangerous. Whenever you get change in society, new political forces may come up and it may undermine your power. So same actually with the economic growth and development. You know, you get broader education of your population, you get new business elites that may emerge and challenge the other ones. So it is actually quite a surprising thing. And it's actually maybe one of the most important things that gives me hope to do about the world, is that actually we do see this change and we see it happening. Now, there is probably still often quite a bit of self-interest in it, why the elite needs to change. That can be, for example, and we've seen that over in history quite often, after a serious crisis. You know, if I look at important changes, for example, in Britain, they often came after the First or the Second World War. If we look, say, at Bangladesh, which actually gained independence in the early 1970s, but also then suffered a famine and a very conflictual politics in the 1980s, somehow or another, the elites came together, not in an explicit way, but more in an implicit way, and saying, let's not just fight with each other, but actually, if we want to actually keep our position to some extent, we need to actually offer our population also progress. We need to start growing and so on. And if we look at a very different country like China, if you go back to the 1970s, the 1970s were a really difficult period. The Cultural Revolution had peaked. It was a really disruptive period of time. Chairman Mao died. But there was a huge power struggle in the country. And there was a whole group of people, we refer to them often as the Gang of Four, with Mao's widow, who was really looking for a continuation of ideology over anything else. So then you had a group of reformers that actually probably well understood, and of course Deng Xiaoping was the leader, that actually they could actually lose the state. In fact, I remember as a young child, people talking about the possible end of China in the late 1970s. And actually what they understood as reformers is that if they wanted to keep power as the Communist Party of China, they would have to be more pragmatic and to gain again legitimacy from the population to growth and development. So it can also be out of looking for legitimacy from the rest of the population.
Interesting that you mentioned that, because the question that I had was also how much of this elite development bargain is personality driven? Yeah, does it require a central leader that pushes this vision forward, or does it occur organically? And from what you've described, the examples you've given, it can really go both ways.
Exactly. And I think that's a really important thing. I am not a big fan of the theories that say it's all about the commander in chief. It's all about the leadership in that sense. But of course, you do need people that forge and work with an elite bargain. You know, you do need people in politics, in business, in other parts, in other walks of life that actually are really good at bringing people together, providing, for example, a narrative, a clear story of why this is happening. You know, there is something to do with, in any politics, that a really good leader tends to be the communicator in chief as well, the one that actually can explain both to the elite players as to the broader society why you're doing what you're doing. Because let's not forget, growth is actually quite tough to achieve, because it means you're not consuming today because you actually keep on investing because you want it actually to generate a return tomorrow. So in a very poor country, that does need explaining both to elites and to broader populations. So there is something about being a communicator in chief rather than a commander in chief that actually requires somehow people that can actually play that role within societies. Now, in some countries, it's one or two people. In other countries, it changes rapidly, but they fulfill that role. Finally, in other places, it's very hard to put a name on it, why actually the change was happening. It's not a simple thing like the leader matters. No, leadership matters, but it doesn't mean the leader. It doesn't have to be an autocrat. It doesn't need to be all power vested in that one person for to have this progress.
I'm speaking to Stefan Durkon, professor of economic policy at Oxford University and the author of Gambling for Development. When we come back, can development happen in a country with weak institutions? Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
Thanks for staying tuned to the Breakfast Grill. I'm Shazana Mokhtar, and today I'm speaking to Stefan Durkon, professor of economic policy at Oxford University and the author of Gambling for Development. Stefan, you cite three conditions needed for a development bargain to be successful, namely peace and stability, a mature, sensible state, and the ability to learn from mistakes and course correct. Are these conditions a prerequisite for development bargains to be formed, or do they determine the success of the bargain itself, which is to say that development bargains can fail without these criteria?
Yes. So that's a really excellent question. Maybe make reference to quite a tradition in development thinking that emerged and probably was crystallized in a well-known book by Acemoglu and Robinson on Why Nations Fail, where they basically tell us that development comes about when you actually get your institutional development sorted. Now, the interesting thing is that these kind of institutions, and I mean there the nature of governance of your country, the rule of law, the recognition of property rights, and so on, they would argue that gets shaped in history. And it's one of these difficult things in development, saying if we take a strong institutional approach where you say we need to sort out these institutions or nothing can happen, you're actually just waiting for a better history. You know, you tend to give advice to your country and say, well, get your history sorted, and now you can then afterwards develop. So it's not a very helpful way of looking at it. Now, I think the interesting thing of a lot of countries that have in recent decades developed, they didn't start from perfection. And that comes back to your question, is that, yes, you do need, maybe as a precondition, you need to get something about peace and stability. It's very hard to see this happening without some peace and stability. But peace and stability, and all countries in the world know this, needs to be worked on all the time. It needs some kind of credible politics, pragmatic politics, to keep actually the nation together. You know, we see it too often in the world that seemingly peaceful states actually start crumbling apart and getting a lot of instability. So it needs a lot of work. But it can be worked on. It doesn't have to be perfection. You know, you don't have to have the perfect situation. Now, the other conditions about being a self-aware state, a state that is sensible, what I mean by it is, first of all, you know, you will only be successful if you understand your own state. And so it doesn't have to be perfect. But if you know it's not perfect, and let me give an example. If at the time in the 1980s, the Bangladeshi state was definitely highly corrupt and not very strong and quite dysfunctional and with low capacity. One of the smart things that Bangladesh did in its deep poverty that it had, you know, the world was writing it off at the time. They didn't really think much of what would happen in Bangladesh. They actually didn't try to do it all via state-led development model. They didn't try to build up a development state that they simply couldn't deliver. They actually let much more happening, for example, through NGOs. A big part of social sectors in Bangladesh was delivered and still is by NGOs, local NGOs, in fact. BRAC is the largest NGO in the world, non-governmental organization providing services to its people. So you allow that, so you're self-aware. And the same with learning, of course. These are not preconditions in a strong sense. I think the real precondition is the commitment to make it work, the underlying shared commitment of the elite to get growth and development. And then you keep on trying to correct yourself, learn in both in the economy, in the way your politics works and so on, something that then works for your society and then allows it to move ahead.
I want to just maybe continue a little bit in the vein of institutional strength, which, as you pointed out, you don't think it's necessary for the success of a development bargain. We don't have to wait for perfection. But at the same time, without strong institutions to carry through an economic blueprint, can a development bargain survive if the elite mastermind mind behind this blueprint leaves the scene? What happens then?
It's a striking thing when you look at countries that have been successful. The renewal of this development bargain needs to keep on happening over time. You know, often people talk about, say, a middle-income trap, or somehow countries reach a particular stage and then growth starts slackening. And, you know, we see that around the world. Now, it's actually a sign of, I mean, one shouldn't be surprised within this framework that this is happening. And that also talks then to your point, is that, you know, this elite bargain will need to be renewed, because once progress begins to happen, the economy looks different. There are new power players, there are new players that matter. And it also means that often a new elite bargain has to be struck. You know, when new elites emerge, they will want to have a seat at the table. It provides then somehow requires then a careful management. So you know, it goes both ways, your point. You know, of course, you still need to have people in leadership that can keep on forging that elite bargain. But there's also moments when the original forger of the elite bargain maybe better leaves the scene, because they may not be the right group of people or individual anymore to actually forge that process. I'm thinking of, for example, say Indonesia, where after the coup against Sukarno in the early 1970s, Suharto came to power. But it was really interesting to see that, you know, he did allow a new elite, based on working together with Japanese investment and so on, to come in. He had to keep the old elite happy, controlling often some of the state-owned enterprises and holdings related to oil and related. There was a lot of corruption still there and so on. But, you know, once it comes to the 1990s and we're hitting the Asian financial crisis, he and the people around him become part of the problem itself, and coming out of the crisis to try to renew the elite bargain and to keep growth going, clearly there had to be different players had to come on the scene, and somehow he lost power as well. So you can see it is that, you know, it is actually quite a process. Probably what you also then what we then need to acknowledge, it's not self-evident. You know, there's one thing about takeoff when the system is quite straightforward and simple. It's when you then get a bit richer, even though I don't write about it in this book, it actually becomes then a real issue of how do you renew it. Mm. And then you can probably ask is that you need to more and more codify what is actually in society. And if we think of institutions, it's often a codification of norms of behavior that we need to start getting. And once we get in more complex societies, I would definitely be the one to say is that, well, you better build on these institutions as well, because once a society and an economy becomes more complex, you know, it is you really need to have stronger rules. And I'm thinking here of connected business with government. It's a very much a feature, definitely in early stages of development. A lot of businesses are still closely connected to government, with procurement fraud or connections that play out. At some point, if you want to keep your economy to develop, you'll need to find a way of moving away from that. And then actually you get much more a more competitive, innovative business. And clearly for that, you will need clearer rules of the games, clear institutional development.
Stefan, let's end on this question. You highlight the successes of Asian economies as an example of development bargains that worked. But for a country like Malaysia, the worry now is whether growth has stagnated and whether we've fallen into a middle income trap, whether we can get out of it. You spoke earlier about continuously renewing development bargains. For countries in Southeast Asia coming out of a crippling pandemic, I mean, what do you see as the key developmental hurdles to overcome?
So I think it's really instructive, I think, for countries like yours and the region in general, is that arguably you had one of these shocks some decades ago. And it's actually really helpful to study what you did well and what you didn't do after the Asian financial crisis. And in fact, I find it generally in the world, a lot of countries could do well to study what's happening. Now, if I look back, the most important part, of course, is to what extent in middle-income countries like yours can you reconnect to a preceding growth path? You know, and one of the sad things that we're already observing is that some high-income countries, because both of the way they had the position in the global economy and the institutions that they had, could actually get quite a fast recovery. The more we go to middle-income countries, and of course all the way to low-income countries, the recovery seems to be much harder. So you're sitting somewhere in the middle, and it's a critical thing. Now, we shouldn't forget something like that happened to Malaysia and other Southeast Asian countries after the Asian financial crisis, where the success before the crisis couldn't be repeated. So the growth got slower after the crisis. I think it's really important to use a position like this to keep on having that longer-term focus in mind. Now, it's a really hard thing for a political class to be able to do this, because you're very tempted to do all kinds of lots of short-term things. And of course, poor people have suffered in society. All kinds of groups have definitely lost in their living standards. But it's the actions you take now to keep that long-term horizon will probably affect largely how you actually can reconnect to a growth path. Now, there's certain things, of course, that are coming on top of this. You know, it's not just the COVID shock and the kind of what one thought would be the temporary breakdown of globalization and global supply chains. Geopolitics has changed as well, quite a dramatic way. Of course, first with the relationship of the West with China, and subsequently with the invasion by Russia of the Ukraine. So these two things together are reshaping globalization. Now, it's a really interesting thing that, and I think for the region in general, the most interesting thing is that given that there is definitely a tendency of a lot of, you know, where are the rich consumers in the world still, as of course in OECD countries, that there will be a tendency to buy less from China. And there will be clearly some kind of realignment driven by for political reasons to actually where should we get our supplies from. Mm. Now, it does give a huge opportunity for many other economies, including in Southeast Asia, to actually find a way to actually still take advantage of that crisis, to actually be a more valued partner in global supply chains. But again, you know, I'm thinking of things like certain industries where a lot of resources go in terms of protecting them, and they've never been profitable. And there I mentioned your car industry, that actually is a really tricky sector where a lot of resource and attention goes to. I think Malaysia probably could do well to re-link with that outward orientation it had, because there's some real opportunities there now in the global economy to actually fill in some of the spaces that are being left by China in it. So there's an interesting reconfiguration. Now, I'm not saying I'm right, and this is actually to finish on, but it's the kind of conversation that political leaders can have with a broader society, with business elites, to actually think, okay, where could we be, rather than where do we want to be, but where can we be in this new situation, and to get some real alignment, possibly with some winners and losers in industry, winners and losers maybe in society, but actually saying, look, but if we want to be a fast-growing country that is broadly development for the population in 10, 15 years, it's at this moment that gets shaped. But I'm the first one, having worked inside the government during the crisis, the short term takes over. And that's actually kind of the biggest thing. A development bargain is a long-term vision. It's a long-term idea, realistic, but it's actually driven for actually getting something better in the longer term. And that's the biggest challenge I think political leaders have at the moment.
Stefan, thank you very much for such an insightful conversation.
Well, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
I've been speaking to Stefan Durkon, Professor of Economic Policy at Oxford University and the author of Gambling for Development. This has been The Breakfast Grill, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, where unlimited potential begins.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.